Yo, so we got Glenn Murphy.
Hey,
Glenn Murphy from the UK. Sistema. So I don't know. You call yourself expert or whatever, but a Sistema enthusiast instructor,
practitioner. We'll put it that way. So yeah,
practitioner. Bit of a champ, you know. From what we just do, we just spend half an hour to an hour going through some stuff. It was intriguing the last time we spoke. So I you know, this idea of drawing down from, you know, making this connection with the place around you and drawing that into yourself and having that kind of fluid self-other boundary, but then, you know, being able to direct that into, you know, all kinds of things, whether it be a strike or hitting somebody with the idea of them hitting you or something like that. Anyway, I loved all of it, and I thought we might, you know, get into ideas about consciousness and cognition and, you know, non-brain bound cognition and haptics and all that kind of thing, because I think you've got some mad ideas about that. Yeah, if you want to introduce yourself a bit better than I've just done, then let's get stuck in.
Yeah. Well, name's Glenn Murphy, and I'm originally from the UK, from the southeast, down near southeast of London, where the Channel Tunnel is. If you know where that is, across to France. That was my hometown, Folkestone. So, but I moved. Actually, I live in the States now. I live in North Carolina. I've been here for quite a while, and I teach Sistema. I've been doing martial arts my whole life, pretty much, judo, jiu-jitsu, all kinds of different stuff, mostly Eastern, Japanese, Chinese modalities and stuff. But about 20 years ago, I met a guy who was teaching Sistema, this Russian style, in London. Took that up, and it just profoundly changed my perception of what it is to practice a martial art and what it's for. More than anything else. And then meeting the real practitioners of the art, the people, you know, they're not just playing at it, but the people that live it day to day and have really kind of lived it in difficult environments as well. And just feeling their presence and their ability to, I don't know, understand you and people around them and the world almost just seemingly out of this kind of intuition, which is trained, right? It's trained. It's like, there's obviously an innate aspect, but there's a pathway towards training this, which is quite distinct from things like meditation and stuff like that. In what I found, I've been training it for a couple of decades and teaching it here in North Carolina for about the last 14 years. And just every year in this practice makes me more open, I find. And it starts to create weird connections, start to make me aware of things that I didn't really see before, and open up to ideas and perspectives that I probably wouldn't have done just raised in the environment that I was. And, you know, with the ideas that I had, and even in civilization, you know, as you point out in sand talk, that constrains you in a certain way into certain ways of thinking about things. And I feel like Sistema was the beginning of breaking me out of those things. It seemed like an echo or a remnant of a much older way of thinking. And reading Sand Talk was the first time that I'd read anything that felt like what Sistema feels like to practice for me. So I think that was the beginning of my fascination with following you and Sand Talk and what was going on. I saw so many resonances in there, and I'm like, there must be some inherent truth in this, right? Because there's inherent deep truth in the indigenous knowledge you're talking about. And there is as well in the practice that I know and feel. So, I think that's what started the connection for me.
Well, it does put you in a different relation to place. Just the exercises you just took me through there, though, these were actually, it was really familiar. So it was easy to hold that, even though we were getting disrupted with the signal breaking.
Yeah. That's interesting. Some people have trouble holding that. That's interesting that you can hold it quite easily.
Well, I'm still in it right now, you know.
Good.
And there's a bit of a story to that. But it's funny because story is kind of how it all works. You know, it's these are your main things, and it's not just an indigenous thing, but it's a human thing, a pre-domestication thing, that everything is spatial. Your cognition is grounded in a spatial awareness, and your way of navigating through that, which is, you know, a lot of inputs at once, is narrative based. So it is place and story that really guides all of your memory, all of your the way you process everything, you know, all the information and knowledge that's coming in all the time, the way you relate to everything and everyone around you. So I've been really interested in Sistema and what that is, but and we have our own story about that connection, because I saw your instructor on YouTube about a decade ago, just before I met old man Juma in Sand Talk, who showed me those symbols. And so that was on my mind, because I saw your instructor. I didn't know who he was, but I was just blown away by this little smiling chubby dude who's doing these motions with his hand, like it looked like your grandma, like, you know, kneading dough or something for a damper.
Yeah.
You know? And he was just like going tap on these huge muscly guys, and they were just dropping.
Right.
And you know, you could see that it wasn't that wasn't fake. Something was going on there. And anyway, we talked about that last time, how, yeah, and how that was on my mind. And you know, I'd always wanted to connect with someone who'd done Sistema and see how that goes. But there's a genealogy too, which has gone right back to Cossack stuff. You know, so historically, you know, where's it all coming from? Let's get that story and the place right first.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit on the blurry side because the stories haven't been carried, I think, contiguously. Do you know what I mean? There's been a lot of interruption and breakup, specifically, you know, during the Soviet Union, I think, and the kind of the suppression of everything old, you know, and in that kind of way. The same thing happened in China, I think. They tried to kind of break a lot of traditional things. And so I think a lot of narrative-based, you know, not the learning itself, probably some aspect of the transmission of what it's for and how it works and how to develop it was probably lost. But certainly the degree of exactly where it came from. So there's kind of conflicting stories and things. Like the near side story is that it dates back to at least the Cold War and a bit further back to Soviet soldiers who trained in this style that was originally kind of indigenous to Russia in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like it was a folk style, a Slavic style of fighting that was then systematized, like literally studied by biomechanicists and physiologists in the Soviet army to try and kind of perfect a biomechanical fighting style that would make their soldiers, especially the like special ops guys and things, super efficient and able to be very, very, not necessarily be the strongest guys in the world, but just keep going no matter what, you know, it's like that Russian, like, is it the best you can do? You know, just no matter what happens, you know, you can't put them down, you know, they just keep going and keep coming.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the near side, like the narrative about war and conflict and rising up. And there's a whole kind of story around that in, you know, that Russia was beset on all sides. You know, it's a long, long land boundary, like with everything, you know, in Eurasia. Yeah. And that, as you know, they have all kinds of different climates across that range as well. So Russian soldiers, Russian people had to be prepared for fighting in a lot of different environments and against and with a lot of different people. Do you know what I mean? Like people with varying tactics. So the idea is that they kind of spread bet with adaptability and endurance instead of putting all their eggs in one basket of, you know, like a really, really fast and precise sword style or knife style, for example, which, you know, in the Philippines or something, they might've gone with that. Instead, they're like, let's just do knives and get really good at it, you know, that way. Instead, they kind of hedged and sort of became extremely adaptable. And that was kind of, that's the narrative about that. But then there's an older story about where did it come from before that? You know, does it, and there's some, tie in with the monastic traditions of the old Orthodox monks and things like that, you know, Russian Orthodox monks and how they used these breathing techniques in the, you know, monastic tradition so that they could pray all through the day and into the night and all that kind of stuff as well. So there's this one kind of religious story, and there's another one that's kind of like a combative war-based story, and both of those come together in the founding myth of Sistema. Do you know what I mean? In that, so that nobody knows 100%, you know, exactly what the genealogy is. It's harder to trace than something like, you know, a specific style of kung fu or something like that. You know, so it's an interesting mix. It's and sometimes, you know, that bothers people. And in certain stages of my training, it's made me think a lot and be like, do I really need to know 100%? You know, exactly what the unbroken line was and where it comes from? Or am I content with knowing that it works and that it does things that are useful and it helps me connect, you know, and things like that? So I think there's been, but some people don't, people like that. They, you know, they have to know who their teacher was and who their teacher's teacher was, and the hierarchy and the lineage is very important to them. Yeah. And if they can't trace that, then they get frustrated and then they go for something that looks simpler, you know, that looks what you're expecting.
Look, I think it's it's more of a genealogy that's important at the population level. At a cultural, rather than, you know, this was Master Sifu and, you know, his bloody acolyte became the guru Tugan Maputna, or, you know, and then his acolyte was guru Hathasmalavina or something, you know, and it keeps going on. That's sort of, I think that moves more towards religion than spirit when it starts to get more hierarchicalized like that. But yeah, something that's just a way of being in living spirit,
Yeah,
you know, a exactly. collective understanding of a people. So you've got you know, all the Siberian peoples and Slavic peoples and all that, that kind of thing in that area for so long. And a lot of that is kind of you know, opaque. Now there's all kinds of different stories that have been mapped over the top of that. You know, I've been talking on this podcast to somebody who, you know, was Latvian, but you know, whose grandmother was Ainu, but you know, more on the Russian side of Ainu.
Yeah,
people are like, ah, but that's Japanese indigenous, and it's like, well, you know, look at the map and those northern regions when it goes up, and it's kind of the
Kuril Islands and that, right? They're all,
and there is a sort of a regional collective culture of Ainu coming out of there, you know, and and so she's had to deal with that, and then the fact that, you know, the country that she grew up in, and the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, and you know, there's a lot of messiness around that kind of thing. But when you think of it in terms of, you know, populations and cultures, you know,
you know, it's not as important as which individuals, but like which people does this belong to, right?
And and you can only think of things in terms of movement too, you know, cultures and movement and exchange, because history isn't about, you know, some creator put all these people, every people and every species in one spot. That was their spot of origin, and then, you know, things have become disrupted. It's, you know, creation is that, it's movement, you know. So when you're looking at a tradition like this, there's movement and migration going on as well. So when I think about the genealogy, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, migratory stuff happening with, you know, all those peoples in you know, Asia, and their way of moving and being in spirit, and then those cold countries, you know, where the, you know, Cossacks sort of emerged, and then what they were before, like, you know, before the industrialization happened, before the revolution even happened, and everything else, you know, you look at that, and then how that gets co-opted by various things and, you know, changed and moves through. But in the
it's
end,
funny you mentioned about stories about
that link back.
You mentioned stories about, you know, some people want to put a stamp on and sort of say, yeah, it started here. And then there's a, you know, almost like a dominance myth that goes along with like the spread of some of these things.
Well, once it's like they're tracking IPR, like they're tracking patents or something. You know, it's like, no, that's not how it works, bro.
Yeah, there was I went to so the biggest training center outside of Moscow in Sistema is in Toronto, in Canada. So I go up there, and that's where I've done majority of my training. I've not even been to Moscow to train with Michael. So the guy that you described is Mikhail Bryabko, right? So he's the head of our system, but he teaches out of Moscow, and until, you know, before COVID, and at least he taught internationally. But so I've trained with him at like week-long training camps when he's been abroad and stuff, but I've not actually been to Moscow. I've done almost all of my training in Toronto with Vladimir Vasilyev, who's his, you know, student, who was, you know, special forces, and moved to Toronto and started teaching there, and just laying seven bells out of local martial artists, and made a rep for himself kind of that way. Yeah. But brilliant guy, and just a phenomenal human being, you know, just so connected with everybody. But I was staying up there one time to train with Vladimir for, you know, a week or so. And I stayed on the cheap with one of his students, this bloke called Ivan. And it was me and my mate Brian. We drove up from North Carolina in like 15 hours and then got there. And they put us up on the cheap. It was like, you know, $20 a night or something. But we got what we paid for. We were essentially in somebody's wardrobe. It was just like a small walk-in wardrobe. And we just had two sleeping bags in there, and we had to step over three other blokes. And we're like, oh, okay, this is what we did. And there was this bloke, this the guy that, I don't know if he owned the building or what, but he was this massive Russian guy. Belly hanging over his belt like that, but muscular too, right? And just deeply sinister. He was always like in the kitchen, just cutting radishes naked from the waist up with a really big knife, you know, just kind of looking at you funny like that. And then every other day he'd drive up, he'd come with a different car, right? He'd just pull up with a different car outside, and he'd be like, oh, Evan, you got a new car? And he's like, no. And you'd be like, all right, then. This threatening look. But this one time we're sitting there anyway, he's cutting his radishes or whatever it is, you know, making borscht or something. And he turns to me and Brian, this point, he goes, you do Sistema, it's good. And I'm like, yeah, we've been training for a while, we try. And he goes, you understand this, you know, you can do this. You may be from Ireland or UK or something. He goes, sometimes you see these black guys, they do Sistema, and they cannot do. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, there's a black guy in my group and he kicks the shit out of me. You know, he's the best one in, you know, on the East Coast. You know, he's really my mate, Roy Hatcher. He's actually a wee black guy and he beats the crap out of me all the time. I'm like, he's actually really, really good. And he goes, no, he does not understand. He goes, listen, one time, whole world was just Russian peoples. Like, goes, and everybody speak Russian. He goes, anywhere you put finger on map, speak Russian. And he goes, and then bad things come. People separate, they start speaking other languages, not Russian, they change, he goes, and then things is bad. And I'm like, sounds like you know a lot about history. Do you, you study history and that? And he goes, some people study history from books, some people get directly from God. Do you understand? He stops cutting and he's holding this knife. He goes, and he didn't even pause. He goes, some people directly from God. Do you understand? Like that. And I'm like, I understand the words that are coming out your face. Yeah. And he left me like it was an awkward standoff. And then he grinned and he thought he'd made his point. But it was just so funny to me that he was so adamant. You know, he's like, this is a Russian thing and it belongs to these old Russian peoples. And, you know, when the world was great, it was mostly just Caucasian people doing their thing. And then something went wrong. It's like it was some weird synthesis of, I don't know, some religious mentality that was in there, but also just kind of this, almost the conquest myth, do you know what I mean? Like wrapped into that. And I didn't know what to do with it. You know, he didn't even train. He talked about Sistema, but I've never seen him training. He's just kind of, you know, around people that did it and stuff, but it really took me aback at the time. And I'm like, this is interesting. I'm like, so there's knowledge here and there's a group of people who train it, but that doesn't mean that necessarily being around it and training it makes you open, right? Magically, it doesn't make you intelligent and make you, you know, do those things. There's still that space for you to absorb fear and bullshit and wrong story. Do you know what I mean? and do all those kinds of things. So that was an eye opener to me, and it was a good warning for me not to be too much of a fanatic. Do you know what I mean about the whole thing? You know, I didn't listen to everything 100% after that.
Yeah, there's you know, it's often like when I tell people, oh, I'm going to be talking to this Sistema fellow, and it's like, oh, you know, they're weird.
we got a mixed rep, like, definitely online.
Yeah, like Russian Jedi sort of weird stuff going on there. You know, I guess there's a difference between story and mythology. You know, and I guess the guy that you just described, that sort of goes over that line, you know?
Definitely.
But it's trying to figure out what good story is. And it's, I mean, I guess straight away, everyone's alarm bells would have been the racism side of what he was saying, because that's where our focus is, you know, from where we're standing right now, you know? But, you know, you got to understand he's from a completely different world as well. So I'm picking up warning bells from other things. And for me, it's about that hierarchy of, you know, this idea of receiving, you know, knowledge, wisdom, spirit, you know, story, you know, from a higher source, you know, receive, rather than that being something that's grounded in the place that we're all standing in. That it's actually, you know, it must be, you know, approved and passed on from a higher source like that. But then, you know, and even that functioned okay as long as it was a collective, you know, it was everybody. But as soon as everybody suddenly had this individual, you know, when you're coming down from that that Russian Orthodox stuff, but then also the Protestantism, you know, suddenly people are having this individualized experience of spirit, you know, whereby they can read the Bible for themselves, they can interpret from themselves, they can pray for themselves alone.
They've got personal Jesus.
and that they have their individual connection to God. And there's something about that sort of facilitated and enabled industrialization, particularly the military industrial complex, you know, which kind of required everybody to be, you know, because those things don't work unless... if people are still in solid communities, people are still in villages, people are still taking care of places together, a standing army doesn't work. A seasonal army works, but you can't have a permanent standing army.
So just because they're always going to care more about their place than they are about.
Yeah. So you have to break people down into individuals, and you have to separate them from their place and their connection with land and everything else. And I guess that's yeah. And so your path through and with Sistema, you know, it's interesting because it's kind of reconnecting people back into place.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, spirit, but in quite a material way.
Yeah, I guess.
Connecting through the body and that sort of haptic consciousness, whereby your awareness is spreading out, you know, initially through your senses, but then beyond them and into the place around you until you kind of merge with the place.
Yeah, definitely. There's a huge emphasis in Sistema. I mean, it's weird. You know, I know that Sistema takes a lot of stick online, and people look at some of the exercises and the drills that people do, and they're like, "That's not a martial art." And you know what? There's some truth in that statement. In a lot of ways, it's not a martial art. It's an operating system, and it's a way of kind of relating to the world and practicing relating to the world to cast off layers of artifice, so that you can better understand interactions, and one set of those interactions is conflict, right? And so you can use it to better enable appropriate responses to verbal conflict or physical conflict. And if you really drill down into it, you can practice hard that way. And we just feel like martial arts is a really good way to test that, right? I mean, you can pontificate all you want on a cognitive level about how much you understand about yourself and about people and your emotions, and you're like, emotions are constructed in a soup between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex, and you know there's some argument going back and forth between those things, and then it's referring memory and some other things, and this is what an emotion is. But as I understand that, I can circumvent it, and I can get over the top of it, or I can meditate my way out of it in small doses, and like, okay, now let's see what happens when somebody punches you in the mouth, or like you've got four people lying on you, or you feel crushed or pressured in some other way. What you actually feel is an overwhelming emotion that you're not quite aware of what to do with. You suddenly don't understand yourself and your body anymore. You feel like you had certain expectations of who you are and how you respond, and those are completely wrong. And so the story that comes after that for those people that try and, you know, explain away all of emotion and all of kind of human experience in terms of cognitive versus affective and all those things, is that, okay, in that instance, what happened was amygdala hijack, and you've just gone into this animalistic brain, and animals are less than us. Do you know what I mean? There's another hierarchy there. Mm. And so you went into stupid lizard brain, and then that basically forced you to have leave of your higher brain and your consciousness, and then you couldn't do anything about it, and now you're just a stimulus response thing. And then you're like, okay, well then which are we? You know are you saying are we a whole entity, are we a whole being who can try and understand what we are, or are you just sort of saying there's a cop-out at the point when you're in danger? And in Sistema, we don't say that. Like in some martial arts they say that, you know, you get beyond a certain point of panic, and you're just going to be gross motor skill and adrenaline and cortisol, and all you can hope to do is big movements that smash and run away because you're going to be that panicked. In Sistema, we don't accept that, and we practice being in the situations that, and initially they do produce cortisol and adrenaline, a lot of panic and fear, and then we drill that and we experience it on purpose, and we try and get a complete picture of who we are, like emotions, warts and all, right? The whole thing. And then we work outwards from that. So like instead of learning how to defend yourself against, you know, a jab and a right cross, being like, okay, first step here and then cover up and then do that. We're like, first thing happens is somebody puts their fist on your face and they push it as hard as they can. And they just keep doing it until you get irritated, right? And then they practice hitting you in the face. And then you see what your response is. You see what your current state is and what your tendencies are. And then you actually work outwards from there. So there's this acknowledgement and even emphasis that your what you think of as your higher brain and your, you know, the rider sitting on top of the elephant, right, hasn't got anywhere near as much control as you think, that you need to respect and understand the elephant. And that's what's really riding the show most of the time. And then your job is to synthesize the body with the brain, not to try and get control of the body. Do you know what I mean? So we're not like beating an animal into submission. We're really trying to acknowledge the whole piece. And then once you've done that, you have a chance at connecting with other people.
You're being in a response. So when violence is done against you, that's not just happening against you. There are externalities to that you can't even see as well. You
know? Sure. Yeah.
And being in a response is a very different thing to reacting.
Yeah.
From reacting. And pretty much if you're in a response, then it could be the worst thing ever that's happening to you. You could get maimed up, but you're not going to have the same trauma if you're, you know, you're being in that response, because you're genuinely inhabiting what's going on and you're not just reacting in the moment. You know, I've got, since the last time we talked, I've been training up with this fella for a while now, and he's had to break me down to like real foundations. You know, so he put all his, he's got all posters of babies up on the wall in his studio, because he reckons babies know exactly what to do. So, you know, everything he does, like with the foundational stuff, it's taking you back to baby again.
Like kind of crawling and
movements, your basic way of your way of moving, you know, right the way through to toddler, every way of moving, and then and you know where the movement starts and ends, but not just that, but the motivation for it. You know, what's the baby's motivation for wanting to reach up there to start, like everything, and and the response that they have. So yeah, he's had to break me down and start me right from scratch. But that's the thing, the other day he said, no, I've been listening to some of your, you know, podcasts and that, and you're always in response and in control and in that realm and in your, you know, field. You know, you always have a response, and you're in that, and you move with the person, it's relational and everything else. And he said, but
I try to, we all fall out of it.
Yeah, but when we're training, you know, every time I hit you, you're in reaction, you know, and so we have to get you there to where you're in that real response.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually walking your talk of being in relation to place.
Well, that was so interesting.
Sorry, keep going.
No, yeah. And that's where I find it so interesting, because, you know, initially when you talk about motivation, it's like, why does a baby reach out for something? It's because it wants it. It just fucking wants it, and that's it. Do you know what I mean? It's uncomplicated, and it's as if the movement comes from inside the bones. It's just like, give me that, you know? But when we try and pick something up, there's like hesitation. There's like a preparation. There's just like, is that there? There's like serious, there's layers of, you know, feeling like, who's looking at me doing this? Do I want it? Do I not want it? And we complicate things a lot of the time until we get drunk or something, and then we're fine. Then we move like babies again. Do you know what I mean? Like we're disinhibited in a certain way, right?
And there's that weird god of drunks who looks after. Like you've seen, like sometimes, you know, you've seen a drunk guy get hit by a car and then just get up and walk.
Unfortunately,
away.
Yeah, most of the time, yeah.
It's like it's too bad. And next day, no bruise even. You know, he's just like, I got hit by a car. What?
So that's exactly it. So that's on a physical level, that's what we're trying to train to do, is actually to regress a little bit and remove these layers of reactive fear and tension that live in the body first, and then find their way into the brain. And once you can get yourself to that place, you know, you can just fall over at any angle and, you know, flop onto the floor like a baby and you don't get hit. Or you can absorb impacts, not because you're bracing up, you know, but because everything is just absorbed like a water bag, you know, it goes all the way through you. So that's like the base state from which you can start to see the corollaries to that in everyday life and conversation. Do you know what I mean? Like when you realize how much you react to people, you know, how much you're just defending your ego or pride, or do you know what I mean? Or just defending that idea that you're either better or worse than somebody else. Like as you talk about, you know, that principle, the greater than or less than principle, you know, I understand that I've got ego. And sometimes if somebody challenges something and I feel like I know about it, you know, the science of it or something, then I'll stay on it a bit too long sometimes, you know, like I'll have to make my point and have to make sure somebody knows. But through Sistema training, I've caught myself in that more often, a bit more often, you know, and I realized that, why am I doing that? Why am I trying to position myself as greater knowledge, right? Why is it so important to me to have the end point of the conversation? It's like, you know, and the same on the other side as well.
All systems become fragile when they become disconnected from other systems.
Yeah,
you know, and that's just a law.
Yeah,
you know of complexity. That's how it works. That's one of those, you know, basic laws of being in the land. It's just the physics of your reality. You know, you become brittle, you become fragile when with separation. Yeah. So it's that sort of reunification, and the exercise we did earlier, you know, it was kind of you know, gaining an awareness and being in a state of connection with everything around you.
yeah,
you know, all into the room and then even down into the land, you know, beneath and everything that's there and everything around, the air, everything else, to make sure that that sort of fluid self other boundary was right on over on the side of being quite unified with everything around. Yeah. And, you know, you have that feeling of, yeah, I could get hit right now with a baseball bat and that wouldn't just be shattering this here, you know, that would ripple out through,
yeah,
you know, that energy
still hurt. It still hurt, but it might not
throughout all of this, you know. Well, yeah. And even if it was just about sense of being able to make sense of that trauma,
yeah,
you know, in that instant and in the immediate aftermath, you know, most trauma is about, you know, a failure to make meaning, a failure for that to come into your story.
Absolutely.
You know, this failure to deal with the dissonance of, oh my God, this should not be happening to me.
Yeah.
To me, I have rights and this isn't fair. And I charitably give over there and there and there. Karmically, it's not my turn to have something bad happen to me. You know, but right. I think, you know, yeah, there is no ledger. People don't really understand that, and
not really, you know, how it works in nature.
Yeah, and and, you know, violence just is.
Mm-hmm.
It is in the world around you. You don't have a right to live without it.
It's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because that's not what's been taught.
But it's been part of the individualization of people. So the idea of human rights, it started, you know, after the French Revolution, and, you know, all those revolutionaries who were, you know, trying to put together new industrial hierarchies or pre-industrial, you know, to move into industrialization, you know, hierarchies in France there. And they're coming up with all the rights of man and everything else. And really the nature of human rights came through there, what it's all based on. And that, that highly individualized thing, which ironically is bringing people under vast monocultures at the same time. So basically, and it came up with the Jewish question. It's whether Jews were allowed to have human rights in this new world. So as the rights of man were being developed. So they debated this for a while, and the idea that came out of that most intrigued me and that made me go, aha, that's it right there, was this idea that, well, yes, Jews can have human rights individually, but not as a community. So the Jewish community does not have the right to exist, but Jewish individuals do.
Interesting.
Yeah, because that would bring them into the big monocultural project of nationalism and of moving towards these great nations, these ideas of, you know, not just city-states with empires, you know, but that big movement that the world was moving towards of creating nations and of that being the next iteration of control and governance.
Do you feel like that was a conscious process, that they were really trying to drive it that way, or was it just
kind
when
you look at all the theorists of the time, it was and it was, you know, I mean, they had lofty ideals. It was about, you know moving, pushing back the darkness of uncertainty and superstition and you know, oppression and, you know, all this sort of thing like that. Yeah, and, you know, creating this great marvelous future, you know, through technology that would be controlled and manipulated by, you know, those people who had the God-given sort of superiority, you know, to be the elites, you know, over, you know, the struggling masses and the herd, which was interesting. I mean, it's kind of how revolutions go. Revolution is just usually another turn off the wheel in a Game of Thrones kind of sense, you know. It's just, you know, all a revolution ever is a establishment of a new hierarchy and a new elite. It just sort of shifts power from one elite group to the next. And you keep seeing that. And it means that, I mean, you can't have communities, you can't have villages, you can't have, because when you have that, people have food sovereignty. And when they have food sovereignty, they don't have to depend on your breadlines. They don't have to, there's nothing you can hold over their head to force them into battle beyond just the seasonal sort of feud that they've been doing forever in feudalism. You know, seasonally, you could force people into battle and they'd have to grab their shovels and go off and try and fight bloody you know, knights in armor with their shovels, yeah, etc. But you know, now before this industrialization, the military industrial complex, you weren't able to force people into a permanent standing army. But then all of a sudden you could. And France pretty much fought the entire world and won most of the time after they got that in place, you know. And you know, and that was concurrent with what Prussia was doing. And then, you know, but of course the pipeline between Prussia and the United States, there was a lot of cross-pollination there. So they were really building up the way of having a having a totalitarian sort of regimic sort of structure that at the same time felt like freedom, you know, something that people would willingly come under, you know. And so it's interesting, we were talking about the story of Sistema, you know, coming from that from that Slavic sort of way, which was quite you know, people from the land and their way of being in spirit on that land, and then moving through this Cossack thing. But then the Cossacks, how in the ways that they were kind of used as auxiliary troops almost, but kind of, you know, special forces almost, by the Tsarists and all that sort of thing. But and then, you know, gradually moving through, and you can see every tradition has been sort of squoze, through this. It's been through the ringer. But adaptive traditions, you know, they shift and change and make themselves what they need to be in order to be useful and to have continuity, you know, coming through. And you can see that in a lot of traditions.
I can definitely see that a lot in Sistema. It's a lot, you know, it's that. I think that's probably one of the things that attracted me to it, despite the fact that I'd done a lot of other martial arts before, right? I mean, I loved doing Aikido for a lot of years. You know, I lived in Japan and studied that, and I liked the culture that surrounded it, and there was a lot of beauty in it, you know, as a system. But it wasn't adaptive. It wasn't a living, breathing thing, right? It was like it had some history, not an enormously deep history, actually, as a comparatively recent creation, really. But it rejoiced in the history of a specific time. You know, it's almost like it was frozen. It's just like this was the golden age of being, like, you know, in Bushido and stuff. And it's like, this is what you should aspire to. It's never going to get any better than this. It was never any better afterwards. This is the ideal. But Sistema,
well, it was an artifact that sort of ended up being taken up all these fanboys. And what's interesting, because the whole fanboy movement came out of that, was it the otaku? Japan's, like, you know, golden years on the rise of their economy.
Oh, Tokugawa, yes, Tokugawa, during the Tokugawa Shogun.
Recently with the neoliberalism. Hiroshima, when they reformed and they've become, you know, and they enjoyed a big surge of
their reconstruction of
capital and everything else. But there was, and of course, then the crash. So you had the otaku, which is all these disaffected young men online.
Oh, sorry, yeah,
so otaku. They ended up in bloody, you know, 4chan, you know, which became 8chan, which, you know, and you know where that went. and that sort of cross-pollinated across the States too. But the whole fanboy thing rose out of those basically nerds. So the Japanese, that class of sort of Japanese middle class young men who just never got laid, that was where the nerd thing came from, where the fanboy thing came from. And Aikido was part of that, was one of the artifacts,
you reckon? Is that how it
felt? I think like the way that's come across into the sort of popular culture and the fanboy culture, like they all do Aikido and stuff like that. But they want a martial art which is sort of frozen in time, you know, from a samurai kind of tradition time, something that hasn't, so there's this idea that they have some kind of superpower from the past. And this is the danger with, you know, all of these things, you know, where you end up with, you know, a fellow going, you know, once a long time ago, everybody in the world was Russian.
Right.
You know what I mean? Everybody's looking back to a golden age, you know, where things were better. And of course, that's how you get MAGA and all the rest coming through. I don't know. This is just a theory. But you look at that and you look at, the appeal of Steven Seagal, you know, to a certain kind of person. And he's like, yeah, I'm you know, I work for the CIA, you know.
I also cook. And
show them how to do it so they know how to just, you know, disarm a man with a gun like that. I go in and I hope to help out the sheriff's department, and you know, like,
well,
you know,
I think
it's like, he's good, he knows his thing, and you know, like there's that appealing kind of you know, right wing kind of misogynistic nerd fanboy kind of thing that comes out from these things that are frozen in time.
But to be fair, I think there's probably, I mean, there's definitely an aspect to that, I think, around, you know, I remember when Steven Seagal hit the scene in the movies and stuff. And before that, it was all Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee and, you know, fun stuff, you know, like people kicking each other in the head in, you know, remarkable ways, which is really fun to watch on the movies. And then all of a sudden there's this bloke doing these little small movements and snapping people and throwing them around and stuff. And people are like, that must be the real shit, you know? And that was one of the things that kind of hooked me on the idea a little bit at the time, you know, and I trained it for a while. But I think that hero worship of people with the secret sauce, so you don't have to train and actually really figure out what to do. You know, that there's secret techniques that just allow you to circumvent everything that's human and do it. I don't think that's restrained to Aikido and the otaku culture in Japan. I mean, you've got the same things in stories of, you know, legendary stories of guys in China, you know, in like, you know, oh, you didn't know about Jun Fang Wang, who had magnetic arms and could, you know, push people through doors and, you know, all stuff like that. You know, I feel like there's an aspect of that in most traditional martial arts, I'll say, probably maybe not in, you know, MMA and like modern ones and things, but because they're more like, I just want to see it work, you know, with a guy bludgeoning him on the floor. And that's my litmus test, is like, how quickly could he bludgeon another Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt or something, you know? But with traditional martial arts, I've yet to come across one that hasn't got that, some aspect of the hero worship and the golden age in which everybody was better. And maybe there's some kernel of truth in that. Maybe there really were people with abilities that were so different from the ones that we've now achieved with our diluted forms of training. Maybe there's some kernel, but you know, you got to take all that with a pinch of salt, and certainly you can't build a culture around it. You know, you shouldn't build a culture or an identity around that. Do you know what I mean? About being like, oh, my real thing is that I'm going to be a Marvel superhero. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, it is an odd thing, definitely. But yeah, it was a weird thing. It's funny, not only how quickly he rose, but also how quickly he fell. You know, Steven Seagal, you know, he's on the scene and then he's proclaiming himself a bodhisattva or something. And he's, do you know what I mean? He's like, he's on the reality TV show saying, I've also been a cop for a long time. And he went from action hero who probably had the goods to laughing stock in quite a short time, really. Do you know what I mean? He ran that curve quite quickly.
He really did. And he also, he had quite a large role in supporting the rollout of that that mutant message down under book that exploded on the scene. So
what was that?
Yeah. Well, I'm quite close with a number of elders from Western Australia who were involved in the response to that book. So there's this idea of a mutant message down under, this book where white lady from the United States came over, and she was a new age lady, and she proclaimed herself like, all right, all of the last of the traditional Aborigines are dying out, and they're like, you know, disappearing into the world of spirit, and they've named me as the savior and the inheritor of Aboriginal culture and spirituality, and given me the power to transform into animals. Basically, and so she wrote a book about that. And
is this recent? When was it? It was like,
this was about a decade ago, you know. But it was a horrendous thing. Yeah, well, it's there was a lot of backlash, you know, from our mobs going, oh, well, we're still here. And so a lot of the elders, like Anne Paulina was one of the ones, she's been on this podcast as well, actually talking about this too, you know. So her response there, you know, she had to go there, and she was there, and she had to go to the events. And you know, Steven Seagal was there, and he's an Indigenous person, but he's somehow supporting this weird, you know, new age message of that's basically, you know, genociding our entire spirituality, and you know, passing it on to this white lady who can now turn into animals of will and all this sort of stuff. So she went there and dealt with that as well. There were a number of elders that did. Well, they tried to, but you know, it's very difficult to get past Seagal's entourage. But yeah, so he was supporting that weirdly. I don't know. He did this. I remember, did you ever see the film he did where he was like an Inuit dude, you know, who was sort of fighting big oil?
I think maybe I tuned out around that point, like when he started doing straight to TV stuff. That was about
Well, he started wearing this weird kind of indigenous like it sort of felt like this indigenous like parka.
Okay.
And he kind of bedazzled himself somehow. And I think part of it was to sort of try and cover up the fact that he was like getting proper fat too at that stage. He did his best. That was a terrible thing. But there's something about that appropriation of things where it's no longer an exchange, but a kind of a, I don't know, there's a kind of a death. It's in this extractive, this extractive relation. But that's part of that can only happen when you separate from place, which I keep coming back to because I want to return to this idea of this kind of distributed cognition, this place-based distributed cognition, which the first time I spoke to you, I had quite a strong sense that that you were speaking from that.
Yeah.
You know, and not from anything that you've, appropriated from Rus culture right. or anything else, because you're still you're very much in the place where you are at any time, and your cognition is quite, and your awareness is all through that. And you had no problem tracking some of the things that I was talking about at the time as well. So I wouldn't mind hearing you talk a bit more about that in terms of cognition, consciousness, awareness as a distributed modality.
Yeah, I think it's, I think it's largely what you said. It's just the recognition of there is no separation. Do you know what I mean? If you start, I think, with the assumption that cognition has the boundaries of your Swede, that it just lives here and that's all it is, and that yours lives over there and yours, right? And then that's the way that we interact with the world, that I have my experience of the world, you have your experience of the world, and never the twain shall meet, right? Mm. If you start from that premise all the time, you're always going to get roadblocked, right? In how much you're able to understand people, in how much you're able to, it sounds cheesy to say interact authentically with people. It sounds like the wrong word because that word's just been co-opted for all kinds of shit now. Do you know what? It sounds like the wrong word.
I have the sense of what you're saying though. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. You know, the interactions become unclean. They become like a competition for you to superimpose your view of things on the world. Do you know what I mean? That kind of sense. And there's been a lot of books written about this. And, you know, I'm a big fan of like Barbara Tversky. She came on my podcast talking about how, you know, we, the relationship between thought and shape and location, as you point out, that we don't actually think verbally at all, that shape and structure and time actually denote everything about how we think. And just the words and the language actually come after that. They're just like an emergent thing that we stick onto it. You know, we have this mentalese of shape and position and time and distance and relationship. And then when we're babies, that's all we have, right? And then we learn gu and we align that, right? And we assign that to some things. And if we're learning Tagalog, we assign those words. And if we learn, you know, English, it's another set of words. But we've always got this shape, distance, relationship, time-based thing going on in our heads all the time. And the words come after, and we just convince ourselves that the words are important and they're actually what thinking is and cognition, but they're not. They're just a way of us decoding our mentalese so that we can talk to other people. You know, so it's almost like we both have our shapes. I turn mine into English and so do you. Our English kind of interacts here. It gets all fucked up and then it comes back and we make new shapes. And this, what really, again, every aspect of this that I've been thinking about or experiencing, once some part of it jumped out of Sand Talk, it was like, you know, the metaphor, I can't remember which mind that was. Is it dreaming mind? Was we talking about relationship between metaphor and reality? And I was like, there it is. Like the metaphors we use, right? So we have a shape and we try and use a metaphor with a specific language that's constrained by the language. And then somebody else picks up on that. They turn it back into a shape. And that metaphor can denote almost everything about what happens between the two people and what happens going forward. Do you know what I mean? But if you don't recognize that and you just think we're speaking a language and it should just be clear, then you lose something, right? So, but anyway, sorry, I digress on that one. But
no, that's part of it. Yeah, that's part of the aspects of it.
Yeah, so the thing is, I read a lot about this and I've thought a lot about this, right? But I feel like we need to have a conscious experience of it, right? There needs to be some physical practice that can help us understand what it is to have a distributed consciousness, right? And actually see what it does and see how it can work. Almost like you have to have some proof in the pudding, because the opposite has been drilled into us as a culture for so long, right? The opposite, that there isn't a distributed consciousness, that there's one of these and it's in your head and you die and that's it, it's gone. And there's just millions of those all over the world. And so if you believe that at some fundamental level, along with that goes, it's every bugger for himself. You know, if that's what you believe, it's almost inevitable that that's what you're going to end up believing. It's like, yeah, maybe I'll team up and help people out if they're in my family, and maybe I'll help them survive, and maybe I'll join this group of people to fight a war if I feel like they're threatening my security. But at the end of the day, if you believe that you're just an individual and this is all there is, then it's kind of every man for himself at some point, right? But if you start to be convinced of an alternative, in which that there is a distributed consciousness and that you just can't see it most of the time, right? And that you can be shown little physical snapshots of that, that start to crack like little holes in the story, that, do you know what I mean? That start to kind of poke holes in that cultural story that's come down to us, then it can open up some really interesting things. And I want to be quite explicit about it. I don't feel like I'm all that way along this path, right? I feel like I've poked cracks in my structure, and sometimes it's uncomfortable because you want to fall back on the structure that you've been taught, right? You're like, I want it all to make sense again. And sometimes it doesn't when you start doing this, but enough cracks are formed that I can see more, and I enjoy the interactions that I have and the state that I'm in and the conversations that I have when this happens. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I want to spend more and more time in that place, because I feel like that's the real place, and that the rest of it isn't some sort of artifice that I either built around it myself or was taught to me or some combination of the two. But I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, it's what's missing now is story. You know, I mean, to be place-based isn't about, you know, being in a place that's been your place forever and always will be. You know, a lot of people get hung up on that, but it's about being in where you are, you know, because the land moves, the land changes, and so do people, and so does culture and everything else. But you need to have the stories as you transition through that. And usually as there's cataclysms, especially the one you were talking about before with the sort of race to the bottom, the every man for himself thing, you know, you need the cautionary tales. And the cautionary tales are the things that anchor us during times of violent transition. Like that. So it's like that way of experiencing impact, you know, in your martial art, but where there's no trauma that comes with that, because physically you're making sense of that in the space with where the energies are going. It's the same with cultures. That's what story does. Story is the thing that distributes the cognition, distributes the reality and the way of being throughout all the people, not just the people who are there right now, but also the generations are coming, you know, so your ancestors and your descendants, you know, it's something that provides continuity, you know, through that, you know, through all the people who are going to be caring for that place or that land.
So is the pathology, you think, like an absence of story, or is it that there specifically are wrong stories that are getting pushed out? And do those wrong stories, do they just kind of slip in to fill the gap? Do you know what I mean? In the absence of real stories to explain people's sense of meaning and experience, do those things just emerge because we need something, and so it just kind of comes? Or is it the case that it's just so easy for one or two people or a group of people to seeking power or something to create a story because they see that there's an opportunity? Do you know what I mean? They're like, this story would fit the bill. You know, I mean, this would give them meaning and then allow them to mobilize behind me. Or is, I mean, I guess it could be both. Either or, right?
Well, look, you can always tell right story and wrong story. With right story, for a start, it's not focused on... it's not serving individuals. You know, it's not serving a powerful group at the expense of another. So you can always tell from, if you dig around in the externalities of anything. So any act of violence that you do, you know, you can know if that's something that you're doing for yourself, you know, ego-driven, etc. When you look at the externalities of that, what are going to be the knock-on effects of that? You know, so if you do something... So, you know, this fella might be really asking for it and he's making all kinds of trouble, and you come in white knight, you knock him out, and that sorts him out. That teaches him a lesson, you know. You know, it might be someone who's, you know, sexually assaulting women in a bar or something like that, and you think, well, he needs to lose some teeth. So every time he looks in the mirror for the rest of his life, he remembers me and thinks to keep his mitts off. But that's not the end of that story. You know, there are externalities that come from that. There are externalities beyond that.
You know, he might go home and beat his wife more or something.
Well,
you know,
maybe he won't just beat her this time when he goes home. And probably he won't. That'll go further. So in the country you're living in right now, you know, there are mass shootings all the time. You know, like, you know, every few days, depending on your definition of how many people have to be in a mass shooting. But it's generally accepted that it's about at least four people. That's happening all the time. 50% of all those mass shooters are people who've been convicted of violence against women, violent crimes against women, you know, domestic and otherwise. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
50% of all mass shooters. So, you know, this is huge, because the externalities of our violence to each other as males, the externalities are usually visited upon women and children. So any act that you do, if it's in right story, if there's a right story with that, then it's something where the externalities will, you know. So I don't know, if you're letting that guy off the hook and you're like, you know, you're going to calm him down and stop him and buy him a beer and be his best mate, there's externalities to that as well.
Yeah.
So what is that? What is that? That closed but not too rock hard fist that needs to come to that. What is the right story, you know, behind that, where you're, because you know, you create an entanglement when there's an act of violence, or when there's any intervention that you have, or even your your observation. If you observe that and do nothing, that itself, the act of observing it, is an intervention. So there's an entanglement now, and there's an obligation, and there's a story that you all need to play out together. So what is that story going to be? Whereby the externalities, the entropy that's produced there, needs to go into a closed loop where the damage, the entropy, the, you know, breakdown of complexity that's occurring in this system here is actually becoming, is something else's lunch. Is actually making more creation in another place, in another system.
It's so nourishing
that's
something
the
else.
Thing. Yeah. So how do you make that manure there?
Well, that's work? So it's interesting
and
you say
that's
about the fist.
That's the role of story. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, sorry, a bit aside from the story, but it's interesting you say about the fist. Literally, the phrasing that you used was like, "What is the fist that you need? That's not too much and it's not too little. It's just the right amount, right?" That's an example of like a physical exercise that we do in Sistema in order to try and understand that action, right, or that way of reasoning. And it's literally you'll just take somebody, stand them straight, and you'll hit them a few times just with your arm like it's a bludgeon, right? And then you'll tighten the fist up and you will hit them with like some malice in your heart. You know, you'll conjure it first and you'll be like, "I really don't like you, irritate me," and you'll hit them.
Yeah.
And it feels, and the other person, you know, we practice absorbing strikes, and to the other person, when you hit them that way, it feels sharp, right? It feels like a concentrated burst, and it gives them energy in some way, right? It hits them and it motivates them to come up and to hit you back. Like it really motivates conflict. But if you do the opposite, which is you slightly soften it, you've got enough structure in your wrist that it's not going to bend and all that kind of stuff, right? But it's just like a heavy fist that you can just kind of hit in. But when you hit them, you hit them as if you're trying to almost embrace them, right? Like you're trying to give them a hug all the way down to like the feet and the whole body. You don't hit them in like the sternum or the solar plexus. You hit them in the whole body. And that's the feeling that you have. You go, boom. When you hit them with that, it gives them a different feeling. It makes them feel like sitting down and like shutting up, and just like it takes the fight out of you, not because you can't breathe, but because you feel dumb for the organized tension that you have, like the intent that you had. You realize that it was childish and it's
knocking you into an awareness,
and it's not
of
you.
Wrong story.
It
and
smashes
you
out of your wrong story and back
the thing
into the
is
right one.
That it wasn't you that did that blow. It wasn't you that brought that realization into him. It was the place, and it was that spirit, the mother of you know, that landscape. It was yeah. that entity of place that did it.
But you've got to be a conduit for it, right? So you have to clean yourself in the way that we were practicing in order to be a conduit for that. Because if you're not, if you're unclean and you have a wrong story and you hit somebody else, you just transfer more of it back. Do you know what I mean? You just create more problems. But if you can genuinely clean yourself and hit somebody, it goes.
You don't even need to have a story to fill that ecological niche in the narrative landscape. Yeah. All you have to do is keep an awareness, an existence, an openness of that ecological niche.
Exactly.
Because it is a niche and it doesn't have to be filled immediately. It's just like, this is a space here. This is a gap. You and I do not have good story together with this place. And, you know, this place through me is just, you know, giving you a wistful knock now.
That's right. Reset.
Bring your awareness to that empty niche. And it's just like, oh. And that's the thing. But that's what's required everywhere, because it's, I mean, it's just amazing. Everything's an assault now. So, you know, with the tech, everything's an assault. It's, you know, it's surveillance, it's control, it's, you know, it's a kind of colonization of everybody's minds and beings and awareness, especially with the eyeball hours and everything else, you know, that's really tricky to deal with.
Yeah.
Know? And so what is the resistance there? What is how do you maintain some kind of space to go through? You know, the only real effective resistance I've seen anywhere on the planet so far is the Taliban. Who kind of won, and they won forever, and they won against Russia with that. So Afghanistan has been kicking everybody's ass who wants to come in and install some kind of national malware. They're like, no, fuck you, we're tribal. You know what I mean?
Do you think it's partly the land that facilitates that? It's just like, it's just like a, you know, this mountainous kind
of... It's not that. It doesn't matter what the landscape is. If you maintain that connection to it, the land will tell you what you need to do. And it's not like immediately that they run away to the mountains and the caves and just hide out, because they're not just doing that. Everything is a low-tech response that, you know, you can't... Okay. So you can't, it's the same as if you do that response and you push back with that malice and you do that sharp hit back. And then all you've got is a race to bottom for both of you and bad story, and you're both damaged and traumatized from it. It's the same thing. If you jump into that, you try and compete in that technologically dominant space, you know, or you respond to a missile with a missile, if you respond to a bullet with a bullet, then it's, you know, it's different. Where Afghanistan's been amazing is, you know, people are like, all right, we're going to surveil them. You know, we'll find out how they're organizing. We'll tap their emails. And they say, well, you know, fuck you, we won't do emails. We're going to write each other letters. And so they're actually writing letters. They're writing letters on paper with a pencil. Like, come on, you guys. We spent all this money on all this tech. You could at least use it so we can control you. No, we're doing that. All right, well, let's shut down their vehicles. It's like, you know, fuck you. We're not using vehicles. We're using horses now. So we got horses, you know, like we've always done. And it's like, let's bug their houses. Let's bomb their houses. And it's like, well, we're in the mountains now. And then it's like, okay, well, we need to take out that mountain range. Let's send the mother of all bombs there. And it's like, well, we're not in the mountains now. We're on the plains. Yeah. And it's just that ability to move with and inhabit the landscape that makes the Taliban like one of the most successful cultures on the planet. And probably, with the exception of the hijacking of their culture, which will eventually be their demise, you know, by a hierarchical top-down, large-scale globalizing religious ethos. That's what will take them down in the end. But in the meantime, it's that tribal ability to move with and be of the landscape that has made Afghanistan so resilient and which has, you know, rendered them victorious against, you know, every tyrant for the last bloody 10,000 years. Afghanistan's kicked their ass.
And never start a land war in Asia. So. Is that not one that falls out of a Princess Bride or something?
Yeah, man. I did get that reference immediately.
And never, what is it, crossing a Sicilian when there's
death against on a the Sicilian line. When death is on the line.
Well, what a nice little place to end it. See, there's story. Princess Bride, that's good. Nah. Yeah. Well, look, I've been, you know, for a while, you know, I probably wouldn't have been able to do that exercise this morning where I've been for the last couple of years. So basically a couple of years with the advent of me struggling to come into this marketplace and to deal with how to be human and still sit in my community and on my story. With all that, I've received a very large knock to my body and spirit. And my spirit has actually been, like a large part of my spirit has been outside of my body for a long time. So I've been kind of sleepwalking through this life. And trying to, you know, get that back aligned. And I guess that enabled me to work 20 hours a day like a zombie. But it has not allowed me to live and to be and to inhabit story and place in the right way. And as such, you know, I've just done a lot of things the wrong way in the last couple of years. Yesterday I did have a, like some people call it nunkery, but, you know, over here, but basically a practitioner, you know, somebody who knows how to work that. You know, so I finally was able to get somebody to come, like witch doctor, a lot of people would call them, and put that spirit back in. It took them about an hour, but found it, got it, put it back in my body, and I did feel the difference straight away.
So this came at the right time then, this coming?
Yeah. And I look different this morning, and I feel different, and I can, I actually have the physicality where I'm inhabiting. My mind is in my body, and my mind is in the place around me. So rather than talking from a void, I'm actually, you know, able to do it, which was great because you and I got to spend half an hour together before this and work through, you know, an actual physical exercise of doing the distributed cognition. And yeah, it's a very I feel difficult like this is thing my... to explain. Sorry. That's just a difficult thing to explain. It's easy enough to do and to enact, and you can hold yourself in it as long as you are actually inhabiting yourself with your spirit and your mind, and you're inhabiting your place with it. You can hold it. I'm still in it right now, you know, and I feel it. And you know, my belly is active again, and everything is, you know, it's sitting in the right place and working.
Yeah, I feel like this is now, you know, we have different roles at different times in life, but I feel like this is what I'm supposed to be doing now, you know, is trying to lead that fight against what the digital culture is doing, right? How it's just disconnecting us, pushing our spirits out of our body and just leaving them out to dry. Do you know what I mean? And encouraging us to sleepwalk and work because we can do it. There's no reason why we can't live and exist without a consciousness, really. We can tick all the boxes, show up for work and do most of what we need to do without really living, right? Unfortunately, we can in this world. And that's only going to get worse as things get more and more automated.
And we all have to do that. But then at the same time,
we need something, we need this antidote.
Yeah, you need to keep a few guys on ponies in the mountains in your soul, you know?
Well, thanks, man. This is been a blinder. Thanks so much. I'm glad we persisted with it.
Yeah. No answers yet, but lots of pretty good questions. And I think where we come out in the end is that is just make sure we're leaving the space for that good story. And it doesn't have to be forced or rushed. But also there's that idea that, you know, so the good story is what's going to come next and what's going to, you know, get everyone through the time of transition. And it's going to be what will nourish the people who are coming after who have to spend 1,000 years on cleanup. And, but it's good. I think we're starting to nail some ideas of what that looks like and how you can tell the difference between good story and bad story. And I think it's having an eye to those externalities and see what they are and whose interests that's serving. And I think, you know, power critiques are useful in that. You know, that we don't want to throw any babies out with any bathwater.
Right.
Yeah. So, that was a good yarn, Russ. I think we did all right with that, and I think we're going to need some more down the track. Well, let's leave it for a few months again, and then we'll see what see where we're at.
Love to, man. Yeah. Definitely.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot, bro. Bye.
Cheers, mate. Have a great rest of the day.
Yeah.
Russian power about the American.